supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. There's a story I tell often about what happened to me in the aftermath of my accident. It was about a week after the accident, and I lay in my hospital bed, a brand new quadriplegic, with catheters and IVs and braces on me, and I felt useless and worthless and helpless, and all I wanted to do was close my eyes and never wake up again. And I was in the ICU one night, and a nurse came up to me and said, "You're a psychologist, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "May I talk to you?" And I'm thinking, well, I don't have nothing else to do, you know. It's not like I'm busy. But I said, "Of course, of course." And she told me her tale of suffering. She was depressed, and she didn't know she could survive her broken heart either. And I knew what she was feeling. I felt what she was feeling. And somehow she knew that I felt what she was feeling. And at the end of our conversation, I referred her to a colleague of mine who I thought could be helpful. And she thanked me. And that interaction changed my life. I closed my eyes that night and I said, "I can live with this." She taught me that I had value simply by asking something of me, by enabling me to give something to her, changed my life. Listen, our brains are social organs. We're wired, we're hardwired to help one another. Still, things get in the way, things like anxiety and insecurity. But what we might learn from our guest today is sometimes the cure for insecurity is generosity. In this segment of the show, I'm joined by my dear friend, ethicist Stephen Post. He's the author of The Hidden Gifts of Helping. He's the director of the Center for Medical Humanities, Compassionate Care, and Bioethics at Stony Brook University. Stephen, thank you for coming down from New York to join us.
You're welcome, Dan. It is a treat to be here with you and to be in Philadelphia.
Well, thank you. Thank you. In a little while, we're going to hear from Sue Badeau. She's a child welfare consultant and co-author of the book, Are We There Yet? The Ultimate Road Trip, Adopting and Raising 22 Kids. We're going to get to meet her in a few minutes. Stephen, let's start at the beginning. One of your jobs, one of your many jobs, is you're the president of the Institute for Research on Unlimited Love. So how did a bioethicist get a gig like that?
At the time, in 2001, I was sitting in my office at Case Western Medical School in Cleveland. I received a fax from someone Philadelphians know well, Sir John Templeton. He faxed a lot. He didn't email much. I think he thought the fax was the greatest machine ever created. And he asked me, would we start an institute to study the greatest human asset? And I responded by fax, "Great. What should we call it?" He responded, "The Institute for Research on Unlimited Love." I had a moment of trepidation. I faxed back, "Maybe we should call it creative altruism." And he said, "No, unlimited love, $8.9 million. And I responded, as I think Susan would, "I love that language. It jumps right off the page." But he was correct, because it really is about love, and we shouldn't be bashful about speaking of this capacity to look after others and to make a difference in their lives.
So you weren't comfortable with the title, and then he offers you $8+ million. So the message is, everybody's got a price.
Yeah, right.
Some bioethicist. You are.
Yeah, right. Actually, I'd always written about the love theme, about generous love, not the wrong kind of love, the right kind of love. And Sir John just brought it out in me. And he did it in a wonderful way. He was a kind of a mentor. And he was correct, because in the final analysis, all these great traditions, moral and spiritual, talk about love. Love of humanity is what makes the world tick.
You used a word just now that I want to stop you at. The wrong kind of love. Tell me, what's the wrong kind of love?
I think sometimes what looks like love, well, first of all, what's love? And I actually have a definition which is shocking, which I take from a psychiatrist named Harry Stack Sullivan.
Cue the music.
He said, this is really easy to get. Your audience will love this. He said, when the happiness, the well-being, and the security of another person means as much and is as real to you as your own, you love that person. So when you're thinking about a close companion, when you're thinking about a child in a crib, when you're thinking about Cicely Saunders starting hospice to help people who were dying, Jean Vanier with L'Arche, these are people who just have that sense of the value and the meaning of another human being.
I want to unpack that in a few minutes, but I do want to focus on generosity.
Yes.
And what that does for us. I remember reading a study of older adults, and you might have cited this in one of your books, that found that older people who were helpful to others actually increased their longevity compared to a control group. Are we talking about here about the biology of generosity?
Yes, we are. There are now 9 studies which have been published in major medical journals studying individuals from, say, age 65 to 80 or age 60 to 85, somewhat different windows of time. But it turns out that after you factor out all of the variables, the ones who can report informal or formal helping of others at reasonable thresholds, not to overdo it, but at comfortable levels, they have lower depression rates, significantly lower depression rates, and also they're living on average, and here's the figure, about 2 years longer. So if you thought that the way to retire was to go to, Sun City and rise up at noon for a martini, think again. The more you're involved in contributing to the lives of others, the better. And assisted living centers now have gotten the music on this, and they have whole wings where the older folks are, you know, knitting baskets or putting labels on T-shirts for the local walkathon. They're getting this, that it gives meaning and rhythm and hope and beauty to life, especially in those older years.
I have always wanted to start something, and I keep forgetting to call Big Brothers and Big Sisters, but I want to do Big Grandparents, because kids thrive when they're with an older person who just says, tell me, I'm curious about your life. And, you know, older people thrive, children thrive.
It's astonishing. When we were back in Cleveland, a colleague of mine, Peter Whitehouse, and his wife were involved in founding an intergenerational school where you had kindergartners, first and second graders. It was a charter school, encountering folks with mild and moderate dementia who came in from various sites. And, you know, it was beautiful. The people with dementia started helping the kids with spelling, even though it wasn't always easy. And the kids had no idea that these older folks were deeply forgetful. It was just beautiful for the kids, and the older folks felt tremendously gratified. So even if you're losing a little bit of your memory, I'll tell you, one of the most beautiful ways you can cope with growing old and with that particular problem is contributing to the lives of these younger kids.
I got a small vignette I want to share with you and our listeners similar to this, Steve. And by the way, we're that gentle, loving, knowledgeable voice is that of Stephen Post. He's a bioethicist who's written The Hidden Gifts of Helping, among other books. I treated a woman and her mother for a while, whose mother recently became infirm, had to move in with her daughter, and my patient, the daughter, was in her late 50s, early 60s. And the mother was complaining, I'm useless and worthless, and I'm just a burden. And the daughter kept reassuring her, and you know how that conversation goes. She said, I can't help her with the dishes, I can't help her with the beds, and more reassurance from the daughter. And I said to daughter, I said, what have you always wanted with your mother? And she said, I've always wanted to sit down and talk with my mother and have her just listen to me about my life. And mother said, no, that I can do. That I can do. And it improved their relationship tremendously. Not only did it improve their feelings about themselves.
Well, listening is an expression of love, to be sure, as my wife tells me when I don't listen to her. But definitely, you know, the art of listening is so crucial, and there are so many ways that we can express love. Creativity, listening, loyalty, mirth, compassion. It comes in a lot of different packages, but it's all the same idea that that we can love our neighbor.
Well, I'm a psychologist, so I feel morally obligated to look at the dark side of this and the pathology here. So I wonder about the other side. What happens to people who are narrowly focused on themselves, who tend to be or appear to be stingy? Like I said earlier on in the introduction, a lot of this, I believe, comes from anxiety and insecurity, kind of a psychology of deprivation. So,
Dad, I got to tell you a little story. About 3 years ago, I was invited by an organization of widows and widowers on Long Island to give an annual talk to their group. And someone had come out with a study showing that widows and widowers get through grief quicker and in a more enduring way if they can report informal helping activities in their neighborhoods and in their families. So I gave a pretty good talk. And then there was some Q&A. I thought it went pretty well. And then at the very end, there was a guy in the back, and he stood up and he said, I don't care what you say, buddy. I don't do nothing for nothing. And, you know, I knew I wasn't in Cleveland. but the thing is that people limit themselves by this kind of pay-it-back model where reciprocity is like a sword that hangs over their necks like Damocles. And in fact, if you just let that go and realize how fulfilling and gratifying generosity is within limits. I mean, everybody has to draw boundaries, obviously, and we have physical and psychological limits. But as long as you're within those boundaries, it is good for your health, great for your emotional life, and good for your longevity in general.
Well, Mr. I don't do nothing for nothing obviously didn't respond to that kind of insight. So those who don't do nothing for nothing, those who tend to be of themselves and for themselves or their small nuclear family, there's something in the hard wiring there that has to be gently modified.
That's right. And you can exhort, you can role model. That's, I think, the key is having people who show you in the details of their lives, in their activities, their tone of voice, a better way of life. But the science helps too. So we have lots of studies showing, for example, that people who use words like I, myself, me, mine, in a very concerted and constant way, have higher risk of heart disease and depression. We have lots of studies showing that people who are insular tend to find life less fulfilling, and hence the story of Ebenezer Scrooge. He starts out as being miserly. You know, I relate to the world only insofar as it contributes to my agendas and no further. But at the end of the story, as he's had this kind of opening of his heart, he's walking down some unidentified street in some unidentified city, and he's helping everybody in sight, and he has the giver's glow. He has given glow all over him.
I was listening to the radio yesterday, and a great philosopher of the 20th century said, I'd rather laugh with the sinners than die with the saints. Only the good die young. Now, you know, in a way, you can kind of get that. And, you know, the great philosopher, piano man.
Well, a Long Islander, by the way, Billy Joel, who said the world's been burning since the world's been turning. He wasn't unrealistic about human nature, but what he meant there is that if you're good, if you're generous, whenever you die, you're going to feel young. You're going to feel a degree of joy and gratification and fulfillment in life. And I know that's what he meant because I asked him.
Sure. I want to, before we take our break, I want to talk about gratitude. There's an awful lot bandied around today about gratitude, but there's a difference between naming what we're grateful for and experiencing gratitude. There's a vast difference. So how do we get from one to the other?
There's a lot of talk and a lot of research on gratitude. Wonderful institutes exist, like one out in California at UC Davis, and they tell us that if adolescents, for example, just take one day a week, a few hours, and they write down the things they're most grateful for over a six-week period, that they tend to score better on happiness scales and be more resilient when life gets tough. All that's pretty good, but the deep gratitude, I think, has to do with appreciating the simple beauties of nature and not necessarily getting involved in what's now called affluenza. You know, I'm going to be grateful for that yet another pair of $200 designer jeans that I'm going to buy out at the local mall. I mean, the deeper gratitude, the deeper thanks really gets us in touch with the simple gifts of life. And the studies I've done show that, in fact, that kind of gratitude is the one that really works. It's deeper. It's hard to get to when you don't see the awe and the wonder and the splendor around you because you're just so busy texting all the time.
Right, right. This word gratitude, and by the way, you got to admit, you really do look good in those designer jeans.
Yeah, nothing against.
Really, you're a little cute there. Anyway, back to gratitude. It's the feeling of gratitude feels different than being grateful rather than getting gratified. They're two completely different things. So you buy something, you feel gratified. It's very different than being grateful.
That's right. And you could say the same thing about hope and about joy. These are states of being, and they're not really dependent on a lot of things around you. You know, I like to say that optimism is to hope as happiness is to joy, as you might say gratification is to real gratitude. That there's a kind of a depth and almost a spirituality about these things, that they're not just going to be pushed aside because of external situations or things not going quite right. They're deeper and more stable.
Beautifully said. We've got to take a short break, and I just want to comment in something you had said earlier, that women tend to be more generous, and that really, really sets up Susan Bedeau, who we're going to meet after we take our short break. We're talking with Stephen Post, a bioethicist, author of The Hidden Gifts of Helping, and he's the director of the Center for Medical Humanities, Compassionate Care, and Bioethics at Stony Brook. Sue Bedeau is a child welfare consultant. She and her husband Hector have written Are We There Yet? The Ultimate Road Trip, Adopting and Raising 22 Kids. Well, we'll be back after a very short break. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
Alzheimer's disease is the sixth leading cause of death in the U.S. Alzheimer's is not curable, but prescription medications can sometimes help to maintain the quality of life for longer periods. Keystone Clinical Studies of Norristown is conducting a research study to test a new investigational medication for patients with a diagnosis of mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. 610-277-8073. 610-277-8073 or keystoneclinicalstudies.com. Keystone Clinical Studies supports WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host, talking with bioethicist Stephen Love and now Sue Bedeau. So I've given the title of your book about how you and your husband have adopted and raised 22 children. Tell us about that. That's kind of mind-boggling. Most of these children, you adopted 20. Most of them with special needs. You've got two of your own biological children.
That's right.
Tell us about the discussion you and Hector had before you did all this.
Well, to tell you about that discussion, I have to actually take us all the way back to high school. My husband and I are the high school sweethearts, and when we were dating, at that time we talked about wanting to dedicate our lives to children. We had different ideas what that might look like at that time, but it really stuck with us. Even before that, I had read a book about a family that had adopted many children with disabilities from the 50s, which was very unusual at that time. And that had also stuck with me, so I shared that with him, and I said, this is the family I want. And he didn't flinch. He didn't run away. He didn't say, go find somebody else to marry. So we went through college. We got married. We started thinking that this vision we had might mean we were going to have two children biologically and adopt two from places in the world where children are very vulnerable. And that's initially what we did. And so we put a picture on the cover of a book of that period of our life when we had four children.
All right, let me stop you there. You had two biological children.
Yes.
How old were they when you began adopting others?
The second one wasn't born yet. The first one was 6 weeks old.
Oh.
When she was 6 weeks old, we walked. We didn't even own a car at that time, but we walked with her in arm to the local adoption agency and said, we want to adopt a child. We had just recently heard a presentation, actually the day before, at our church about some people who had come back from working in India, and they told us about conditions of babies that were just being abandoned and left on the street, and mothers that were coming up to American volunteers saying, will you take my baby to America? And we just, you know, we were just 20. We were very young. We didn't know a lot about children and the economics and the socio and political issues that we know now, but we said we have to do something. That was just the spur. So we literally walked the next day to the agency and said, we want to adopt a child from India. Which we ultimately did have two of our children are from India. But along the way, we learned so much more about the foster care system here in this country and children here. So most of our children come from here.
What got you interested in kids with special needs?
We knew we were able to have children, and as you know, we did. We had mm-hmm. our two biologicals, so we didn't feel we were adopting only to sort of fulfill that need to be a parent. Although any child you adopt has to fulfill some need within you, I think that's part of the issue of altruism too, is that it goes both ways. You receive as much as you give, and that's, I think, part of why, you know, our first guest was saying it benefits you so much because you do get gain. But we knew there were children that needed families that others weren't putting sort of on the top of their list. At our young, you know, age, at that time we coined a phrase saying we wanted the child most in need of a home, least likely to get one. And so at first that took us to those other countries, and then we learned about foster care. It took us to older children, children with disabilities, terminally ill children, large sibling groups that wanted to stay together or perhaps had already been separated through the foster care system. So as we learned more, our definition expanded of who was included in that.
So you have to admit, you're not an average bear.
True.
All right. And adopting 20 children, having 22, you don't live in a shoe or anything. Like, you're a real person here.
Yes.
I want to know something about your brain. So let's go back to the beginning. I read your background, and you've got lots of role modeling for generosity. You lived in a very diverse community in Vermont where you grew up, And your parents were very active in civic activities, yes?
Yes, that's right.
So what did they do and what did you see?
Well, you know, my parents were always doing stuff for others. They were always they didn't just bring us and drop us off somewhere, whether it was Little League or church choir. They were volunteering. They were in it. They were part of it. They had us involved. They always had their kids involved. You know, we'd go out when my dad ran for school board. We'd help campaign. When my mom was raising money for the Muscular Dystrophy Society, we'd go out with her and do the fundraising. So that was just part of our life, part of who we were. And then I had this great aunt who also just really would help me to see evidence of people in the world who didn't live the same as we did. You know, she would take me places through books. We didn't get to travel a lot, but she would bring me books and take me places through books and stories to help me understand the broader world around me.
Sue, my next question might be a bit uncomfortable for you because it's about Hector. So if it is, just say the word and we'll go on. But his background, from what I read, is very different from yours. He was very poor. He grew up with an unpredictable, sometimes violent, alcoholic family.
That's
and
right.
And nevertheless, for some reason, he was very church-going and became a very devout Christian, just like you. Was that something about him? Was it about your influence?
I think there were many factors, and certainly once we got together, we influenced each other. But his mom, in the midst of all that sort of struggle that their family went through, his mom, I had to laugh earlier when you were talking about the senior citizens in the home and giving back, because his mom, even when she was in her 80s, we'd talk to her on the phone. We'd say, "What are you doing today?" And she said, "Oh, I'm going to go help the old people," she'd say. And she just always had the most amazing spirit of generosity since she was young, and in spite of her struggles, she took in additional children as well. She was always willing to give, and so he had her as his core and as his foundation. Hmm.
Stephen, I want to turn to you here for a minute. Do we know anything about the genetics of generosity versus the environment?
There is a genetic factor, but it's not determinative. Mm-hmm. It's not the whole story. It is true that some people are a little more wired, if you will, for generous behavior than others. But it's mainly a question of what buttons get pushed developmentally. It's about parents and role modeling and culture, non-parent mentors in high school. It's about all the people that you can think of who exemplified this sort of behavior. So the role modeling trumps the genetics. Mm. But the genetics is a factor, and it's not to be trivialized.
And I have to ask, what if there's neither?
That's a real issue. You know, role modeling is everything. Aristotle said, goodness is in the details. It's, you know, I listen to Susan, you know, and I can imagine with her tone of voice and her facial expression, there's a warmth and an engagement and a natural love for these kids. It's also part of your faith tradition, though, and your culture, It's about your mom and your dad and your grandmother. You know, it's about small-town Vermont. It's about a lot of things, you know. And if we don't have those role models, I think it's very, very difficult for people to find the kind of flourishing that brings them a happy life. And I'm very sorry about that, but the role modeling is key.
Can it be learned?
Yes, it can. George Valiant, for example, who's done all these studies of adult human development, has pointed out that even if there are deficits early in life, if you've got a really tough family situation, the rough and tough alcoholic, somewhat violent scenario where there's no empathy and no embrace and no warmth, you can overcome that, his studies show, by non-parent mentors, by marrying a spouse who is empathic and warm and uplifting. So you can get through these things, but you're on a steeper learning curve.
Hmm. I wonder, though, if it opens up something that is already in our hard wiring that has been, that's, you know, never been expressed, almost like a gene that doesn't get expressed, and then something happens, and the gene that's in there, I believe, and all of us, gets expressed. Sue, you were going to say
something. I was just going to add that that's so consistent with how I understand the impact on children's brains of trauma. and the deep impact that that makes, and that's what I do a lot in my work, is training about that, but that it's not hopeless, and that there are ways to, you know, as I call it, build those bridges of hope. There are ways to heal from that trauma and then actually restore some of that sense of both joy but also the ability to be empathetic towards others and have that life that includes the giving and the sort of it's not all about me.
And you need to be open to surprises.
Sue, you found your path for your generosity, for healing the world. But I wonder about an average person who sees someone suffering or sees a community suffering and feels something, feels this kind of kindness and compassion, and then doesn't know what to do. Most of us watching this on TV or reading about this feel hurt, feel compassion, or mirror neurons get activated. But at the same time, we feel helpless, and so everything gets shut down.
You know, Dan, at the beginning of the show, you spoke about your incredible experience with a nurse in the hospital, mm-hmm. and you found a way to live because, my goodness, you could help her her sadness. I think being an active agent is key. Mm-hmm. And what studies show is that, yeah, there is this sort of generic compassion for the suffering of the world, but that really isn't necessarily that good for you. In fact, it can lead to depression and mm-hmm. a sense of helplessness. Mm-hmm. You need to have active hope, and that means identifying some needful constituency that you connect with. Like, Susan, you connect with those 20 kids and your own two kids beautifully. Some people connect with the deeply forgetful. That's what I kind of do a lot of. Some people connect with different groups. But find the group of individuals that you can really relate to, maybe by personal history, maybe by being a wounded healer, whatever it might be. And use your strengths. That's another important factor. Don't feel that you're incapable of helping because you can't draw on your talents and your gifts. Right. Use your strengths. Right. And then form a community so that you can debrief and talk about the meaning and the depth and the value of what you're doing. And all the studies show that those are the three key factors.
Name them again.
Taking care of a constituency or a needful group that you feel called toward.
Okay, two.
Number two, use your strengths, your gifts, so you're not just spinning your wheels and you have an active agency that you can see is bearing fruits. And then the third thing is get together with equally oriented people and sit down and kind of think about what you're doing and debrief and celebrate your activities.
Kindred spirits.
Kindred spirits.
So you said that you wrote the book to inspire others to become active.
Yeah, exactly. And that just what we were talking about now, you can start young and you can start small. Lots of times, particularly people who've been through tough times, children in the foster care system, the constituency that I most closely work with, they're used to people always seeing them as the victim or seeing them as the one that needs to be the recipient of services. And we want them and others to see how you can be someone that gives and how you can be someone that contributes. And at a very early age, you can start doing that, and then you recognize how much better that makes you feel about yourself. And so that was one of the three reasons, really, that we wrote the book was we want people to see that we were so young when we started, and we didn't know what we were doing, but you can do something. You can have an idea, you can have a vision, a dream, and just take that one step. And that one step will then lead you to the next step. You don't have to know the whole picture that we didn't know. You know, we thought we had a picture, and it changed, and it turned into a very different picture. And not everyone will have the same outcome. Some, you know, adopting one child or being a foster parent to one child is going to be their life, and that's going to be awesome. But take that one step, and that's one of the things we really hoped people would gain by hearing our story.
Tell us about some of the kids.
Well, we have an awesome family. We have wonderful kids. We were told on so many times as we adopted our children that, do you know what you're really getting into? For example, one of our sons, he was seven. His name is George, and he was seven when we were about to bring him into our family, and psychologists that had been working with him, and we went for kind of a closing session because we were moving across, you know, to another state. He said, now, I hope you know what you're getting into adopting him, because he might learn to write his name one day, but you can't ever expect he's going to graduate high school or amount to anything. And he was very, very, cognitively had challenges, but he was also very wild in his behavior. He had thrown a desk out of a first grade classroom, things like that. So this is what the prognosis was. Well, he's an adult. He's an amazing man, father, hard worker in the community, but he not only, graduated high school here in Philadelphia at Saul High School, went on to Thaddeus Stevens College out in Lancaster, graduated there. Ran track and made cross country track and made it to the national kind of competition, but he's got such a positive spirit and he's so much fun. You can't be around him without smiling and laughing. So that's one example.
Give me your theory. Why?
Well, first of all, I think in one way it was kind of good that he was told. He heard that was said in front of him, by the way, that initial message. In one way, it was, I wouldn't recommend it for most people. I wouldn't say do that. But for him, it kind of gave, he said, I'm going to show that, that's not going to be true. So it kind of gave him a purpose he even remembered it on his high school graduation day. He said, we're going to send this picture to that. He remembered the doctor, and he named him by name. And we did. But so I think he had that kind of spirit. But also, he needed someone to believe in him. He needed opportunities to see what he could do. So when he got to go to high school where he could work with his hands, he's really good with his hands. He struggled with academics, but once he could start doing stuff with his hands and he could get it. So I think finding that strength, finding that niche, and that story has kind of been repeated with many of our children.
I wonder about the love thing. I mean, what he had in that environment was love, was caring, was safety, was well-being, and as a therapist, research aside, Stephen knows all the research, but as a therapist, you have those things, it grows.
Yep.
It grows. It's like water and sunshine to a plant. It just grows.
I take that maybe love thing too much for granted, and should be a little more articulate about saying it, but that's absolutely right. I mean, that's the foundation, and that's what has to be there as the starting point.
I've got to ask a couple mechanical questions. I mean, you got 22 kids. It's like you don't go out for ice cream after dinner. But you did go to Disney World. You took 15 kids, many of whom had special needs, to Disney World. Car must have been crazy.
It was an adventure. Well, we took several road trips over the years with the kids, and that's part of what contributed to the title for our book. But we would take a big 15-passenger van. We'd take a second vehicle that my husband would drive the big one. I'd drive the smaller one. And, our first time we did a road trip, we said we have to be able to do it in the same budget as if we were staying at home for that period of time. So whatever, we can scrape together out of our normal grocery budget, gas budget, whatever, we have to make our whole vacation fit into that. And we were able to make that work. And so that's pretty much how we did it about five or six times over the years. We'd go all the way across country. We did do Disneyland. We did, see Mount Rushmore. We did the Grand Canyon. And that was really important to us. We wanted the kids to really have that experience of seeing far more than just, our community. We wanted them to see our community, but also see things, have experiences so that they could have visions and dreams about what was possible.
How are your biological kids?
They're awesome, too.
How old are they?
They're, 33 and 31 now?
Yeah, don't give me specifics. Are either of them, both of them, involved in generosity, helping the world, that kind of?
Very much so. One of them more formally and one of them more informally, but what my daughter, does Boys and Girls Club. She does Big Brothers, Big Sisters. She's in her company that she works for. She's the director of community giving or something. That's not her professional title. That's her side thing that she does for the business. So she's very much that way in her life, both personal and professional. Our son is more informal how he does it, but he's always the one that will be there for anybody in the family. And when the nieces and nephews see him, they're the first ones to run up to him because he's always there. He's like a rock.
One.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, we've got to take a short break. I want to come back and continue the conversation and talk a little bit more about love, this Post guy talks about the four spheres of love. So
sounds great.
We'll see what he has to say about that. We're talking about generosity, as you can tell. We're talking about love and what it does to us, to our lives, to our bodies, and to our brains. We're talking with Stephen Post. He's a biomedical ethicist, and he's a director of the Center for Medical Humanities, Compassionate Care, and Bioethics at Stony Brook. More important than that, he is president of the Institute for Research on Unlimited Love. We've been talking also with Sue Bedeau. She's a child welfare consultant, and she and her husband, Hector, have raised 22 children, two of whom biological, 20 children, many of whom have special needs. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
Keystone Clinical Studies of Norristown is conducting a clinical research trial for adults who suffer from major depressive disorder. If you are between 18 and 65 suffering from major depressive disorder, and if your current medication is not working, you may be eligible to participate in this clinical research trial. Participants will receive investigational drug and study-related evaluations. 610-277-8073, 610-277-8073, or KeystoneClinicalStudies.com. Keystone Clinical Studies supports WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about generosity with Sue Bedeau and Stephen Post. Now, as we continue our conversation about giving, we've called out to a local woman who we learned about very recently. Natasha Spencer helped to build her own home with the assistance of volunteers through Habitat for Humanity. She just attended the dedication to her house. Natasha, welcome to Voices.
Thank you.
You must be on cloud nine.
I am. I really am. I'm ecstatic.
So tell me about your house and what you did and what it meant to you.
Well, I actually helped build my house. I put the roof on my house. I put the stairs in my house. I really worked on my house with the assistance of Habitat and just volunteers, other partner families. We got together, and we worked on not just my house. We worked on a number of houses.
And who's living in your house?
It's myself, my three children, and my mother. I actually got to get a handicap accessible house so my mom can come stay with us.
Ah, that's great. Oh, so it's handicap accessible, so maybe Natasha, I could come over for lunch?
Sure can.
Yeah, because very few houses are wheelchair accessible.
I know.
So how did you get involved in all this?
My neighbor actually went through Habitat's program, and she told me it would be great for me. I applied and was accepted.
I wonder if this changed the way you feel about yourself, your life.
Definitely. It let me know that there are people, genuine people, that really want to help other people. You don't find that too often where you have people that don't want anything in return. They just want to make your situation better. This was great for us.
It
helped my self-esteem. I'm pretty sure it helped my children's self-esteem. Yeah.
Tell us about your self-esteem, if you don't mind, Natasha. How did it help yours? What's different about you after this experience?
It makes you more caring.
Ah.
Now it makes me want to help more people. It keeps the ball rolling.
Well, I got to tell you, I'm sitting here watching the faces of my other guests here, Stephen Post and Sue Bedeau. And, you're saying that it makes you more caring, you want to help other people, and they both have this smile on their face, they're nodding their heads like bobblehead dolls. They're happy. You know, they're happy
yes.
hearing this. Well, that's great news. And tell me about plans for the future.
Well, my plans are to continue my education. I'm going back to get a bachelor's in nursing so I can do better. I have a 17-year-old, a 15-year-old, and a 4-year-old. So my daughter's going to college next year. My son, he's trying to look forward to college. And then my little toddler, he's just excited to have his own room and to be able to run freely in a house that's safe, energy efficient. It's just great.
Listen, you've made a lot of people happy just now, Natasha, and I want to thank you and wish you the best.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much, and congratulations.
Thank you.
So, Stephen, Natasha said something, that it's unusual to find someone who just wants to help. Something to that effect. Is she right?
It looks that way on the surface, but when you really get down to it and you look at people's lives, they want to be helpers. Somehow they get the wrong messages in life. They learn that it's cool to be tough and rough, but deep down inside, I do think that everybody finds their deepest flourishing, their creativity, their deeper friendships through helping others. Some people say, well, my friends, they're the people I party with. Well, you know, when you get involved in something like Habitat, your friends are those people that you're working with to do something marvelously creative and good for yourself, but for the world. And so your friendships are deeper and more meaningful because they're with people who share your values and hear the music. So absolutely, I think everybody at some level wants to be a helper.
In your book, you've got a quiz that tests one's ability to engage in selfless love. Is there such a thing as selfless love? Can you love without a self?
I don't think so. I mean, there's two ways living in the world, Dan, and you know, there was a Jewish philosopher named Martin Buber. He says, there's it. I'm the center of the universe. The plans revolve around me. I only care about other people insofar as they contribute to me, myself, and I. And then there's this transformation, which is emotional and conceptual and involves activity in the world. You discover that, no, I'm not the center of the universe, and I value other people for their own needs and how I can help those individuals to flourish. And every tradition, spiritual, moral, philosophical, of any significance, says that you really only find happiness in a deep sense, and joy, and hope, and flourishing, when you move from one way of living to another way of living.
Tell us about the four spheres of love.
Well, you know, I take very seriously the love of the nearest and the dearest. Susan has two biological children, and you love them very much. They're your kin. They're genetically connected. We have biological family. We have friendships. But then you spread that out more widely to the people that you call colleagues and associates at work. You even move it beyond to all humanity. And what you've done so beautifully is you've taken parental love, and you're not just keeping it narrowly focused in on your biological kids, although you love them deeply and that's beautiful, but you're letting it spill over in this remarkable way to kids who are no biological relationship to you at all.
Right.
And that's what I mean by having a wider sense of a shared humanity. And hopefully when we raise our kids, we want them to love the nearest and the dearest and to be good parents, but we also want them to really have that broader perspective on humanity as a whole and on our shared humanness.
Mm-hmm. One of my mantras is that love is habitual, and that the more you love, the more you love, the easier it is to do love, to be love, to express love, and to love fearlessly.
Yeah, and that's sort of like one of our mantras too, in the sense that people say, "How can you have enough love when you keep adding more kids?" And you know, I always say, there's not a limited supply, and it actually multiplies. It actually does multiply. That the more you do love, the more your capacity to love.
And there's research that supports that on a physiologic level. Steve, we've only got a minute left on the show, and you know, you talked about John Templeton in the beginning, and you and John became close over the years, Sir John, I should say. And before he died, he told you he wanted you to write a book about his values. Tell us about the book in 30 seconds.
Well, the request came through his son, Jack Templeton, who's a wonderful and diligent son running the Templeton Foundation.
But locally
here in Philadelphia. But Sir John asked if someone would write a book on his behalf, and he gave it a title. Here's the title. It's a question. Is ultimate reality unlimited love? Meaning that even beyond all these beautiful things that we're hearing about today, from habitat to what Susan's doing, there's this sense in which people ask the question, is the whole universe somehow grounded in love? And that's what the mystics have always been saying.
So it's a question.
It's a question.
Ultimately, reality, unlimited love. But he didn't mean that as a question. He meant it as a statement.
He meant it as a statement. Yeah. I think you're right.
Well, with that, we are going to have to end this conversation. It's too bad because all of us have had a great deal of fun. Subhadeau, thank you very much for coming out here and for what you do.
Oh, thank you.
And to my dear friend Stephen Post, it's so good to see you, and I look forward to seeing your face, and I look forward to hugging you goodbye in a few minutes.
It's mutual.
So thanks for all of you for listening to the show. Listen, if you want to hear it again, you can download our podcast. Go to whyy.org/voices, and we're at Twitter at Voices in the Fam, and I am at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Adam Staniszewski. Elizabeth Perez-Luder is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Please take care. Enjoy your week and be kind.